From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. From Egypt to Palestine, Iraq to Lebanon, symptoms of democracy are breaking out all over the Mideast, and the political right is falling all over itself to take credit.
Many foreign policy observers are hailing the Bush administration's policies and saying the Bush doctrine of spreading democracy throughout the world, there's clear evidence.
The president,
that it's
in talking about freedom and democracy, is sparking a wave of very positive democratic sentiment.
The predicate was doing what George Bush and this administration did in Iraq, the example of the brave Iraqis.
But what if the credit belongs not to American foreign policy? What if the major catalyst is a more elemental democratic institution, namely a fledgling free media? Masked terrorists, anti-American screeds and all. What if Pan-Arab satellite TV news, including the widely despised in the West Al Jazeera, turns out to be the force that ultimately empowers citizens throughout the historically authoritarian Arab world? Hisham Melhem is the host of the weekly program Across the Ocean on Al Arabiya TV, and he joins me now. Hisham, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you've witnessed this both as an insider, as an employee of Al Arabiya, and as an outsider, as a reporter for various Lebanese publications. What is the concrete street-level effect that the satellite channels are having on Arab citizens throughout the Arab world?
Well, Bob, for many years, Arab governments managed to build artificial walls among various Arab societies, and it made it very difficult for Arabs to understand what was taking place, not only in the wider world, but also in their own wider culture. And with the advent of the satellite phenomenon, Arabs from Morocco in the west to Yemen in the east are watching and listening to almost unedited raw footage concerning, for instance, the popular movement in Lebanon. And they are quoting Lebanese and before that Iraqis and Palestinians speaking in Arabic language that everybody can understand. And when you look at delimited elections in Saudi Arabia, the municipal elections, and if you look at the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, discovering for the first time the virtues of elections, which means that there has to be more than one candidate, I would argue that one of the reasons could be that new public spheres that was brought about by the new technology and the new media, i.e. the satellites.
You work for Al Arabiya, which I think is regarded here in the West as a more West-friendly version of Al Jazeera. Are Al Jazeera's critics, which, by the way, have included this program, are they missing the point that however inflammatory some of the rhetoric is, however incendiary some of the pictures are, that the democratic value of unfettered media far and away trumps the particulars of what is said on the broadcasts?
On the whole, if you want dynamic, vibrant societies, and that should, of course, include media, then you have to take the good and the bad at the same time. And that's why it was very disturbing when we hear Secretary Rumsfeld denouncing Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya in broad brushes without being a bit specific. My thought is always that, okay, if you don't like certain aspects, you criticize them, challenge them, engage them. And that's the way to do it, not to lambast them and to support them when they do something that suits your interest and denounce them when they do things that you don't think are in your interest.
I'm curious to what extent the coverage of what's going on even reflects the idea that the American ousting of Saddam Hussein was potentially the key that unlocked democracy in the Arab world?
It is definitely a factor in the discussion, especially among intellectuals and academics, definitely. But the Arab media phenomena brought to the Arab certain realities about the outside world. One of them is that the Arab world is lagging behind every other region in the world, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa. And for people who have old memories, for these states who are built on old cultures that contributed greatly in the past to world civilization, they look at their current messy malaise and led some people to say, look, maybe not all of our problems should be blamed on the Americans and the Israelis and this and that. I mean, maybe our biggest problem is bad governance. Throughout the last few decades, there has been a ferment in the Arab world for reform, for empowerment. People were chafing under the rule of various autocratic Arab regimes. Obviously, if conditions were not somewhat ripe in the Arab world for change, not even the invasion of Iraq or invasion of another Arab country would change anything.
The 20th and 21st century of Arab media is that of states controlling the message to a very great degree. And
true.
In individual countries, there's very little free press. I guess Lebanon is excluded from that. One of the reasons, I suppose, for the flourishing of the satellite news channels is that they enable citizens all over the Arab world to get what they can't get from their homegrown media. Are the governments going to be able to get one step ahead of Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and whoever else comes along?
Most Arab governments are not comfortable with this new phenomenon, definitely, because it is intrusive and because it exposed them and it exposed the bankruptcy and the limitations and the ineptness of their own national, quote-unquote, mass media that are controlled by government. And I think the genie is out of the bottle. And while, theoretically speaking, the government of Qatar today can silence Al Jazeera or sell it or change it or stop it, it is going to be extremely difficult for anybody to crack down on this new phenomenon.
Let me ask you about the competition. Al Jazeera, by most measures, is considered the dominant channel. Then Al Arabiya, your station.
Right.
But then there's also Al Hurra, which is financed by the United States government.
True.
Has it had any impact in the marketplace of ideas?
Nil to nothing, really. Because it was seen by Arabs as a propaganda tool. Arabs, for a long time, did not trust, for good reason, any media outlet that was financed by a given government. And Al-Hurra did not manage to hire people who are very well known in the Arab world. And when you have an outfit like this, to be seen as credible in the Arab world, you should act like the BBC or the way we look at NPR here. Maybe public money is behind it, but it has total editorial autonomy, which was the case of the BBC, and every Arab knows that. Al-Hurra did not act that way. It did not create that impression in the Arab world. And fair or unfair, most people don't watch Al-Hurra right now, although your tax dollars and my tax dollars are behind it.
I think it's important for us to realize that we're in this for the long haul.
Kenneth Tomlinson is the chairman of the Broadcast Board of Governors, the agency behind Al-Hurra and other public diplomacy efforts around the world.
We're in this to spread freedom and democracy, women's rights, economic opportunity around the world. And we cannot seek to gauge from month to month or even year to year how successful we are, so long as our broadcasts are providing basic news and information to people who need it.
If Congress approves the president's supplemental spending request, the board will soon expand its Persian language satellite transmission from a half hour a day to 1 hour repeated 4 times a day, giving Iranians, he hopes, a bigger window to the West.
Iran is an information-deprived society. People of Iran do have access to any number of broadcasts from abroad. They're private broadcasters broadcasting in Persian or Farsi. But the only way people have in Iran of following the important events in Lebanon today is through Western broadcasts. They certainly don't get it from inside Iran.
Is that all there is, basic news and information, or is there some propaganda afoot?
No propaganda, news and information, plus debates. You have to realize that in large portions of the world, people have never heard the principle of women's rights defined. People don't understand the important advantages in our general free economic system. The right of the free press is not observed. So when we even have debates where one side is putting forth these principles and the other side is putting forth the forces of darkness, we win because people for the first time hear our side.
How do you combat the intense suspicion surrounding anything the United States does in the Middle East?
You see, I go back to the days of the Cold War, and I know the effect that broadcasting had on the people of the former Soviet Union and the people of Eastern Europe. I know the power of information, the power of truth. I saw a revolution in the former Soviet Union. I saw the Berlin Wall come down in no small part because of the role that the radios played in giving people the information they needed to make up their own minds. 24/7 broadcast to the Arab world on Al Hura, our significant increase in satellite television to Iran. These are aimed at allowing people their right to know.
It's really apples and oranges.
Former State Department communications specialist Nancy Snow is a senior fellow at the University of Southern California's Center for Public Diplomacy.
I think we can learn a lot from our history and the effectiveness that VOA had, but we're living in a very different time, and the audience is more sophisticated, but they're also much more skeptical. We need to recognize that the United States is seen in many parts of the world as really the number one propaganda nation in terms of our legacy of broadcasting, public relations, advertising, and marketing, these persuasion industries.
Well, there's two ways to look at this sort of propaganda. One is that the United States is just so ham-fisted in its efforts that all over the Middle East and now Iran, people are rolling their eyes at the clumsiness of our approach. And the other is that we are so ultra-sophisticated that we are wizards penetrating people's minds and changing their point of view with them scarcely realizing what's afoot. Does either of those scenarios reflect reality?
Not quite. I think that we are sophisticated with the technology, but we still have a lot to learn in terms of the effects of what we're doing. What we know from research is that you can produce some shift in attitudes, but you rarely produce a total conversion.
You've said about a Farsi language satellite service that, quote, people could see it as a sign that an invasion is coming. It's the sort of thing that happens before nations build up their war effort. Now, there has been some saber rattling with respect to Iran over the nuclear issue. In the past, has the Voice of America and similar efforts been the electronic equivalent of dropping leaflets by air over a town to say clear out?
Well, not necessarily Voice of America, but broadcasting in general. We saw with the war in Iraq, taking out the information infrastructure, the so-called Saddam TV. And this is an ongoing debate. Is that really part of making war against another country? Do you first take out their ability of the enemy population to be targeted by its own media? And I think that in some circles, it is a legitimate target in terms of information warfare. So I'm just saying that to some, it could be seen that the more that the United States uses broadcasting to Iran, that it could be interpreted that that is just priming that population for an invasion. That was, of course, a very provocative statement from an American, but I think internally that wouldn't really be seen as too far out there.
Okay. Well, Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Propaganda expert Nancy Snow is an assistant professor of communications at Cal State Fullerton and a senior fellow at the University of Southern California's Center for Public Diplomacy. We also heard from Kenneth Tomlinson, chairman of the Broadcast Board of Governors, and to begin the segment, Hisham Melhem of Al Arabiya TV. Coming up, the evolution of Washington journalism, and a White House spokesman actually answers questions. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield with a little trip down memory lane.
During the campaign, the president did not express, as you put it, disdain for nation building. What the president said is the military should be used for the purpose of fighting and winning wars, exactly as we did in Afghanistan. And then there are other areas of the government that actively are involved, should be involved, and will be involved in nation building.
That's former presidential press secretary Ari Fleischer playing dodgeball with the White House press corps in February 2003 on President Bush's stunning policy reversal. Working for probably the least accessible president in modern history, it was a game Fleischer had to play often. Here he is commenting on reports that President Bush had told a senator he would rescind an executive order prohibiting the assassination of foreign leaders.
I've looked into it. I can't confirm that he did say it.
Did you ask him about it?
The president doesn't recall if he said it or didn't say it. The staff doesn't recall the president saying it. But bottom line remains the same. The executive order is in place, and so it's a hypothetical that doesn't exist.
In his new book, Taking Heat, Fleischer by no means offers vicious and culturish cheap shots against the media, but he does voice his own frustrations. Fleischer's bottom line on that, the White House press corps, he says, has two fundamental biases.
The first being that the press is biased in favor of conflict, whether they're covering a Democrat or a Republican. And secondarily, I do believe that there is a subtle ideological bias in the press where it's just easier to be a Democrat talking to the press about policies, and especially social policies, than it is to be a Republican. Make no mistake, the press is plenty tough on everyone. They were relentless on their coverage of President Clinton and his ethics. But I do think when it comes to policy and social policy, the press largely sees things through the eyes of the Democrats, and it shows up in subtle ways.
All right. Let's just put liberalness aside for a moment and talk about the conflict part of that. I know you don't imagine that the press is a transcription service. I mean, isn't the whole point to shine the light on the corridors of power and hold the government accountable to the people? Isn't it inherently a conflict situation?
Yes, the press has and will forever have an ongoing obligation to shine that light regardless of who's in power, and I have confidence they'll do that. But I also wish I had confidence that the press would shine a light on the good things that happen in government. The press focuses on what's wrong. The government that defensively focuses on what's right, and the two good institutions talk past each other.
Well, hasn't the press earned its right to not pay a whole lot of attention to what the administration, whatever administration it is, represents as being the good news? Let's talk about the Pentagon Papers and Watergate and Iran-Contra and Monica Gate. It's the history of the sitting administration lying to the people in the press. If you were on the other side of the podium for those 2.5 years, wouldn't you have been a little on the skeptical side yourself?
And everything in my book supports the notion that reporters will continue to be and should continue to be skeptical. But that doesn't mean that they should abandon their mission of also telling the American people what is right. Take Iraq, for instance. I think it wasn't until the election that really people started to focus on, is it possible that good things could happen in Iraq?
Let's talk about weapons of mass destruction. You had to stand there day after day and speak of their existence with certainty.
That's correct.
How do you feel about that now?
Well, it looks like, doesn't look like, from according to the weapons inspectors, I was wrong. And nobody ever likes being put in a position where they say something that turns out to be wrong. But you have to make a distinction between, was I wrong because, as the president's critics said, I lied or the president lied, or was I wrong because the information turned out to be incorrect, as we later found out. When George Tenet says to the president, it's a slam dunk, Saddam Hussein has biological and has chemical weapons, the same conclusion that Bill Clinton reached and Al Gore reached, then I think you have to say, were the president's decisions justified on the basis of that information or not? And that is what he was told.
I want to pull back a little bit and ask you about the difficult position that a press secretary is placed in. Now, you obviously don't want to be standing there getting caught in a lie, but there's truth, Ari, and there's the whole truth. In court, you have to put your hand on a Bible and swear to tell the whole truth. Could you have done that before your daily press briefings?
Absolutely. I don't know why there should be a presumption not to. Well, let me make a very important caveat to that. There are truths that I never discussed with the press, of course. And no press secretary has discussed the whole truth about things. For example, I was asked if the United States would use nuclear weapons in Afghanistan. Now, should I answer that question? Or when the president submits a proposal to Congress, like in 2001, $1.6 trillion tax cut, and people on the Hill are saying it's way too big, we'll only support it if it's $600 million, no higher than that. And then reporters come to me and say, will the president accept, you know, $1.2 trillion? Is that a reasonable compromise? Now, should I answer that question also? There are all kinds of ways press secretaries don't answer questions, that press secretaries duck questions. Does that mean I'm not providing the whole truth and therefore I am being less than truthful? Of course not. It means that there are some questions that cannot and should not be answered, and no press secretary should answer them, and I wouldn't.
No, I can't see that. But of course, what I'm getting at is when not answering the questions is a way to save your president from political heat, which may be deserving.
Well, like the question to the president at a news conference of, tell me a mistake you've made. And he wouldn't answer that one. He couldn't think of one. But here's what would happen if he answered the question. Within 12 hours, a commercial would have been on the air from the opposite campaign saying, Bush admits this mistake on Iraq. And then the commercial's tagline would have been, if even Bush says he's wrong, we can do better. something along those lines. And then there'd be countless stories following it. Not everything happens in a vacuum.
So there's actually, you're making my point for me. Politics and the truth are essentially incompatible. And right in the middle of that, there's Ari Fleischer at the podium trying to broker the truth.
No, how do you get the politics and the truth are incompatible from there? No, of course they're compatible. But there is also an exercise in our democracy where reporters want to write the next big story. They want to get ahead of the news to the next development. That's their training. That's their instinct. And it's what reporters should do. But there's also the serious business of government, which sometimes is best conducted in quiet, in a deliberative fashion. And that's going to forever be tension between the press and the government, regardless of who's in power.
All right. Well, Ari, thanks very much.
All right, Bob, my pleasure.
Former Presidential Press Secretary Ari Fleischer is the author of Taking Heat. Tension in the Washington press corps is not confined to the relationship between the media and the government. It's also internecine, as a century of technology has altered the definition of who exactly is a journalist in the first place. In his new book, Reporting from Washington, U.S. Senate historian Donald Ritchie documents the sometimes awkward evolution of the Capitol's press coverage, an evolution complicated by the profession's ability, via the credentialing process, to cling to the status quo.
Washington is very unlike most other capitals around the world. In other countries, the government decides who is a journalist and who gets a press pass. Here in Washington, it's the reporters who judge who is a legitimate reporter and who should be credentialed. And this goes all the way back to 1880, at a time when lobbyists were infiltrating the press gallery, posing as journalists, trying to get information ahead of the news, in a sense, because they knew it was valuable, and when some journalists were moonlighting as lobbyists. The journalists felt that this was the politicians' fault. They were letting everybody into the press gallery. So around 1880, the leaders of the Washington Press Corps went to the Speaker of the House and the chairman of the Senate Rules Committee and said, we will take over running the Senate press galleries and the House press galleries and accrediting the proper reporters into the galleries. And they established rules of, you know, what it takes to become a reporter. And they published them in the Congressional Directory, and then they scrutinized each of the credentials that came up. They elect a standing committee of correspondents.
Now, the advantage of this is that the press can keep government agents and lobbyists out of the press galleries, essentially posing as journalists when they have other agendas to pursue. But the disadvantage is that it can become a kind of de facto guild where reporters get to limit the pool of who gets to call themselves a reporter.
Well, very naturally, a reporter will define a reporter as someone doing the job that he's doing. So a daily newspaper reporter would decide that to be a legitimate reporter, you have to report for a daily newspaper. And that eliminated all of the black reporters initially because they worked for weekly papers. And the mainstream daily newspapers were not hiring black reporters at that stage. They also required that you had to file your reports by telegraph. That eliminated all the women in the 19th century because they were writing society news for the most part, and they were sending theirs by mail. It went from 20 women reporters in 1880 in the press galleries to zero women reporters after that. And it's really not until the Second World War that enough men leave to go fight the war or cover the war that jobs finally open up for women in the press galleries.
Membership to this elite corps was not only based on race and sex, also by medium. It took a while for radio reporters to become part of the club. Tell me about that.
Well, the first radio reporters showed up on Capitol Hill in the 1920s, but they couldn't get into the press galleries unless they also reported for a daily newspaper, and therefore met the criteria that the reporters had set. That was fine initially because the first radio reporters were newspaper reporters who were just sort of doing it on the side. But once you got into the 1930s and you had reporters who were just reporting for the radio, well, they couldn't get into the press gallery. So in 1939, a correspondent in Washington named Fulton Lewis Jr. went to the Congress and said, if the press gallery won't let us in, you have to create a separate radio gallery. And since, of course, the politicians want to be covered, they said, fine, and they created a radio gallery. And that was the beginning of a trend in which we have separate types of galleries depending on the technology for which reporters work. And nowadays, we have a whole new form of media that's developing, and it's encountering the same kind of resistance.
No blogger gallery, eh?
Right, not yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if someday there wasn't an electronic gallery that would somehow admit or decide who actually among the bloggers is a journalist. The concern, of course, is that every 14-year-old with a modem and a web page could put in for press credentials, and the press galleries feel that they'd be overwhelmed. And the question is, you know, who is actually a journalist? Who is really a lobbyist? Who is involved in a special interest group as opposed to actually trying to objectively cover the news? And they have not yet figured that out. They're doing it on a case-by-case basis. There have been some lawsuits to try to get the galleries opened up. But certainly the recent incident at the White House is a very good example as to why they need to scrutinize these applications very carefully.
Well, let's talk about that Jeff Gannon episode for just a moment. He was a reporter for a right-wing online news website called Talon News, but it came out that he was more or less a mole for the Bush administration, although there's no direct connection that's been established so far. Does history offer us any other examples of moles operating from within?
Every presidential administration in modern times has accommodated people that they felt would be sympathetic in the press corps, because those are the people who will ask the easy questions at the press conferences, and those are the people, of course, who are reaching a constituency that the administration hopes to get. You can go back to the days of Franklin Roosevelt, when he found day passes for Walter Winchell, who was sort of the Matt Drudge of his era. He was a gossip columnist in New York. He used to say he turned mud into gold. He was probably the most popular columnist of the 1930s. More people read his column than read, for instance, Walter Lippmann, and his radio show was extremely popular. But he really wasn't a journalist in the traditional sense, and he couldn't meet the criteria to get a press pass, according to the Standing Committee of Correspondents. But the White House always found a reason for him to get into President Roosevelt's press conferences, because in those days he was very sympathetic to the Roosevelt administration. Other administrations haven't necessarily brought in people from the outside, but they've known that there have been people in the press corps who are more sympathetic than others. So beleaguered press secretaries look around for those people to call on them at the right particular time. President Kennedy used to call on Meg Craig, who is a woman correspondent, a very short woman who wore very flowery hats to attract questions. She would get called on because the president knew she would ask eccentric questions of him, and then he could get a sort of a wry answer back that would get a laugh and that would diffuse some of the tension from some of the more serious questions that were coming in. So presidents and press secretaries are definitely looking for allies out there in the press. Most reporters, of course, don't want to be identified as an ally. They want to be seen as an independent. But there are some who clearly see themselves on a mission to promote whichever administration happens to be in office at the time.
Well, Donald, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Senate historian Donald Ritchie's new book is Reporting from Washington, A History of the Washington Press Corps. It's available from the Oxford University Press. This week, for the first time ever, a blogger was granted access to the all-important White House briefing room. Garrett Graff, editor of Fishbowl DC, a media bistro blog, fought diligently for the credentials that got him in. He joins me now from Washington to tell his tale. Garrett, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Okay, so one day you're just sitting there going, I'd kind of like to go to the White House briefing. How did this all happen?
My blog covers journalism and the media industry in Washington, and the Jeff Gannon story over the past couple of weeks here in D.C., where a fake journalist from a fake news organization using a fake name covered the White House briefing for 2 years, has created sort of a lot of discussion about White House press credentials and these press briefings that the press secretary holds every day. And I thought it would be interesting to go in and cover the briefing and talk about the process to get in and get a White House credential.
And how difficult was it?
I expected it to be not the easiest thing in the world, and I was not disappointed. The process that I went through ended up taking a full week of 20-plus unreturned phone calls. But since my story was as much about the process to get into the White House as it was about actually getting into the White House, I was blogging all of this. And it ended up getting a lot of attention, both online and from sort of members of the White House press corps. And finally, Ron Hutchinson, who covers the White House for Knight Ridder and is president of the White House Correspondents Association, went and met with Scott McClellan and said, I think that you should let this guy in. He's got a legitimate desire to cover the White House. And Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, said, it's your briefing room, you being the press, and if you want to allow bloggers in, we'll allow bloggers in.
So during the whole Jeff Gannon fiasco, it was frankly unclear as to who was making these decisions. Was it Scott McClellan? Was it the congressional press galleries? Or was it the White House Correspondents Association? Who does decide who's worthy to be in the room?
It turns out that it's a combination of the White House press office and the Correspondents Association to a certain extent, because neither the White House nor the Correspondents Association is particularly comfortable saying who is and who is not a journalist. So they deal with it by establishing very low barriers that include you have to have a nonpartisan and independent publication, you have to be supported by advertiser or subscriber revenue, and you have to be a regularly published publication. So I made the argument that I met all of those criteria, and they seemed to agree.
So you were on this holy quest, and thanks to your patience, diligence, persistence, and Ron Hutchison's intervention, you got what you were looking for. And I guess you went to the White House to sit in the briefing room and participate in the gaggle. And what exactly did you learn?
It's hard to not come away at some level impressed with what goes on there every day. But I was also shocked at how, shall we say, subpar the working conditions that the journalists live and work in there are. They have very little space. It's very cramped and sort of drab and dreary. But as one correspondent pointed out to me, the White House is loath generally to make capital improvements on the press room because the last thing any administration wants is to make the press feel comfortable and encourage them to stay longer at their desks.
Well, Garrett, thanks an awful lot.
Thank you very much.
Garrett Graff is the editor of Fishbowl DC, a blog published by Media Bistro, and he has a day pass to the White House. Coming up, two subjects the media just don't understand: budgets and guns. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. A few weeks ago, President Bush kicked off the annual game of political football known as the budget process, unveiling a $2.57 trillion spending proposal. It's only the first step. Now it goes to Congress, which will bat it around for a few months with the help of the Congressional Budget Office. Meanwhile, the rest of us, with the help of a small cadre of Washington reporters, will try to make sense of what's going on. Joining us now is Douglas Holtz Aiken, director of the CBO. Doug, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk turkey, Doug. From reading the papers, I certainly know what to make of this proposal. It's very lean, or it's deficit exploding, and it's true to the Republican cause of shrinking government, or the opposite, it's actually growing government. I don't know what to make of it based on what I've read.
All of those statements are true from a certain perspective. When the president puts out his budget, it assumes that every single part of his policies, every economic policy, every social policy, is enacted in whole. When the Congress looks at a budget, it begins with the Congressional Budget Office baseline, which assumes no changes in policy, which is to say nothing that the president puts out has happened. Obviously, there's a great gulf between the two, and the delivery of the numbers by the press in a political environment is a very difficult challenge.
Well, if everybody's out there spinning and none of the statistics that are cited by either side can be taken at face value, what is a press to do?
You can, in fact, try to come to terms with those numbers which are plausibly too large to be believed, those numbers which are ballpark right, and those which are small enough to ignore, and get some sense of what's really on the table. In the current environment, I think the press has made it very clear that among the key elements of the budget picture right now are the costs of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the money is not in the budget but provided in a supplemental. So you got to add that in somewhere. They've made it very clear that the president's approach is to keep a very tough line on a certain category of discretionary spending, which is non-defense, non-homeland security, annual appropriations. And I think they've made it very clear that that's not the whole budget picture.
A lot of reporters, to one degree or another, are, because the budget itself is like several phone books thick, are using some of the aids provided magnanimously by the White House to cut through some of the detail into the heart of the budget. In relying on these materials, are they actually misrepresenting certain objective facts from the budget to the readers and viewers?
I think it's always better to, at least at the beginning, spend a little time mucking through the numbers yourself so that you understand what's in them. I'll give you a very particular example that comes up all the time. In the budget process, there are two different concepts. One is known as budget authority. That's money in the pipeline. You want to think of that as sticking money in your checking account, and that's an allowance to spend. And then there are outlays, which is like writing the check out of your checking account and tell us how much you've actually spent. That's the geekiest problem that reporters face. As is well known, in late 1999, 2000, 2001, lots of authority to spend was given, particularly after September 11th. Those bills are now coming due, and so the outlays are coming out now. The authority was given years ago. One group wants to claim there's a tight budget now. Another group wants to claim there's a lot of spending now. They can both be true simultaneously. You have to make the comparisons on a fair basis.
When the president offers a budget that shows growth in all of the major areas of spending and what may or may not be some cuts in the very narrow discretionary part of spending, and still asserts that he is going to cut the deficit in half within a reasonable amount of time, isn't it absurd on the face of it? And if so, what should the press do?
Well, I think the press should evaluate the claim at face value. Find out what it means to cut the budget deficit in half. Is that in dollars, or is that as a fraction of the size of our economy? Right now, the deficit's 3.6% of GDP. Does cutting it in half mean coming to 1.8? Or, right now, the deficit's $412 billion in 2004. Does cutting it in half mean you come down to $206 billion? Find an objective, find a time period, and then ask someone to connect the dots on the policy. What I would like to see the press do is take any claim on either side of the aisle and first check it against a neutral set of numbers. And having decided what that claim really has in the way of content versus exaggeration, then pursue the story. Often that step gets skipped, and they go to the other side for reaction, and it becomes a political story and not really a policy or substantive story that will help the reader understand where the source of real disagreement might lie.
So let's just pretend for a moment that you're not, in fact, the head of the Congressional Budget Office, but a reporter or an editor. You've seen this document. What's your lead?
My lead is White House strategy to cut deficit, very heavy political lift, and even if they succeed, big job left to be done.
That may be the best summary I've seen so far. Doug, thanks so much for joining me.
I do hope this was helpful. I enjoyed it.
Douglas Holtz Aiken is director of the Congressional Budget Office, and he has some busy months ahead of him. Ever since Election Day, the media have been wringing their hands over failing to understand how much cultural values matter to voters. Among the most polarizing issues, gun ownership. Media tend to stereotype sportsmen, collectors, and hobbyists as raging gun nuts, and gun owners tend to see media conspiracies to repeal the Second Amendment right to bear arms. OTM's John Solomon went out in the field, literally, to find some common ground.
When it comes to gun policy, the National Rifle Association and the New York Times editorial board are usually firing broadsides at each other. Now the NRA has invited the editorial board to go shooting with them. And the Times public editor Daniel Okrent believes they should.
I think it'll be wonderful. I think it'd be a really, really good thing for the readers of the New York Times.
In a column last summer, Okrent wrote that gun owners are, quote, among the groups the Times treats as strange objects to be examined on a laboratory slide. For them, he continued, a walk through this paper can make you feel you're traveling in a strange and forbidding world.
It plays out in the paper in coverage that is not empathetic. I think journalism requires a certain empathy. You have to understand what the person's position is and why the person feels that way. And on gun issues, I feel, generally speaking, the Times writers and editors who address these issues cannot or choose not to, I think it's more cannot, find that empathetic connection to the person who really wants his guns.
That lack of empathy is not limited to blue state media, according to Mike Needs, ombudsman of the Akron Beacon Journal. He wrote a column this past fall suggesting that journalists, even in his red state of Ohio, have a blind spot when it comes to guns.
When I walk through the newsroom and I talk about what I'm hearing from people in the community, why don't you have more hunting season coverage? The reaction is that, well, I don't think we need to do that because that's not something that they're interested in.
Needs counts only one hunter on a floor of 170 newsroom employees. That despite the fact that 4 in 10 Americans say they own at least one gun. It's a disconnect that makes this man's job much easier.
How you guys doing today? Everybody a member of the NRA?
On a recent Saturday morning, Harry Jacobs, an NRA membership recruiter, is manning the organization's booth at a gun show in the small eastern Pennsylvania town of Jim Thorpe.
Would you like to get some information? Give you $10 off and a hat.
A 58-year-old turkey hunter named Dick offers a representative opinion of what gun owners think they're getting for their $15 NRA membership fee. He believes the media are out to take guns away from private citizens, and the NRA is the only obstacle in its way.
They don't look at the gun collector or the hunter as a law-abiding citizen. I mean, I think they're working together to disarm the American public. And, I mean, that's their objective. And we need the NRA and we need the people to stick together, or that's what's going to happen.
Nearby, Kenny, a cherubic 54-year-old, has a rifle in his right hand and a homemade placard advertising its features hanging around his neck. A lifelong deer hunter, Kenny says he's never seen a realistic depiction of hunting in the mainstream press.
The fun part is the anticipation, the scouting, the family gatherings, the strategy sessions, the BSing and all those things. The going out with your brothers and family members and good friends getting together, and that's something that's never covered by the media.
Like many men here, Kenny fully supports the NRA's opposition to gun regulation, because he fears any concessions will lead down a slippery slope to a complete ban. Another man says I should especially appreciate that position, since no institution talks more about the potential for a slippery Bill of Rights slope than the press. He suggests I look up a 1994 Washington Post editorial, which called the assault weapons ban largely symbolic, but added, its virtue will be if it turns out to be, as hoped, a stepping stone to broader gun control. To many Post readers, that may seem like throwaway boilerplate. But to gun owners, it serves to reinforce their suspicion that the media's ultimate objective is less to reduce illegal gun use than it is to take away all their guns.
It does not help when you have editorial writers make statements that appear to be hostile to gun ownership per se.
Dennis Hennigan is the legal director for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence.
That just plays into the NRA's hands, and it allows them to, again, reinforce their case that there is this conspiracy, essentially, against gun ownership and that they are the guardians of freedom.
In fact, research by Brian Ontspatrick, author of The NRA and the Media, found a strong statistical correlation between negative editorials in the top U.S. newspapers and spikes in NRA membership. Ironically, Patrick says, the strong gun control rhetoric hampers the cause by alienating and energizing gun owners.
More bad press equals more NRA members. In fact, I'll put it flatly. If it weren't for bad press, NRA couldn't possibly be where it is today.
Just as helpful to the NRA as bad press is careless press. One notable example occurred 2 years ago during a live gun demonstration set up by CNN Miami bureau chief John Zarella. The story was pegged to the congressional debate on the assault weapons ban. Zarella arranged for sheriff's deputies to shoot a variety of weapons that he said would become legal without the ban.
Now that was semi-automatic.
That's
going to switch your automatic.
Now this is automatic.
Wow. That obliterated those blocks.
The problem with Zarella's demonstration was that the fully automatic machine gun he referred to had been banned for public use since 1934, and therefore it had nothing to do with the legislation before Congress. Gun owners may have also found one of Zarella's questions to a sheriff to be somewhat loaded.
So clearly, this has nothing to do with right and to bear arms. This is clearly an issue of there's no place on the street for a weapon that can do that kind of destructive power.
Several days later, CNN felt it necessary to have host Miles O'Brien issue a rare on-air clarification.
We reviewed that demonstration and decided that a more detailed report would better explain this complex issue.
I don't feel that most reporters are inherently biased. I think that there is a lack of understanding when it comes to covering the issue of firearms.
Andrew Arulanundam is the NRA's Director of Public Affairs.
It's very difficult for folks who have never fired a firearm or have no desire to fire a firearm or no desire to go hunting to understand the culture.
To gun control advocates, the press has mistakenly lumped gun control in with cultural values issues such as gay marriage. In fact, according to CNN's Paul Begala, journalists' lack of experience in the field has caused them to miss the more valid link between hunting and the environment. Begala, who has been a hunter far longer than he's been in the media, says the press portrays the sportsman vote solely in terms of gun legislation, when government decisions on the environment, such as wetlands preservations, will likely have a far greater impact on the lives of hunters.
The most powerful environmentalists I know are hunters, because they see firsthand. It is not an abstraction for them. They actually spend time in the outdoors. They want to take their children to hunt and fish in the same place that their father took them.
The NRA's ability to frame the current discussion comes after years of self-inflicted media problems, according to Michael Bain, who hosts several gun-related shows on cable TV's Outdoor Network, including the NRA-produced American Rifleman.
The pro-gun side was virtually media dyslexic. We had no idea what the media wanted from us. We didn't know how to give it to them. And besides that, we thought they were out to get us.
Bain's side is now taking a more open stance with the press. He created the Aiming for Accuracy program for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, an industry trade group. It brings reporters to ranges to do some target shooting and learn more about guns. As part of my own effort to learn more, I accepted an invitation from Todd Smith, the editor of the hunting and fishing magazine Outdoor Life, to shoot sporting clays at the sprawling Orvis Sandinona grounds about 80 miles north of New York City. On arrival, I was equipped with yellow earplugs, a black shooting vest, orange protective glasses, and a brown Cesar Guarini 20-gauge shotgun. An Orvis instructor, Jim Dobbs, showed me how to hold the gun, its butt to the crook of my right arm, my face up on the gun barrel, and how to load the two yellow rounds, not bullets, as I initially called them. Before we shot, Jim previewed the arc of the two birds, actually black and orange clay discs, that would be propelled into the air one after another.
Okay. The secret with this is to look up high, pick up the bird, and always have the gun in front and under, and follow through.
I approached the wood stand, I loaded the gun, and called for the first clay to be launched.
Pull.
And shot.
Good. Follow through and under. That's nice. It. Beautiful.
Perfect. I had hit one.
All right.
Actually shattered it.
Dead center.
By the end, I had fired 90 rounds total. My arms were exhausted and my cheekbone was bruised from the unfamiliar shotgun recoil. The scorecard said I had actually hit about 40% of the clays. But that was not the only surprise of the day for me. I was particularly struck by how obsessed everyone was with safety. Todd Smith from Outdoor Life said that's a common reaction of his neophyte guests.
It's not about shooting up the countryside. We went out, we were safe, we had a really great time, we had a beautiful day. And that in and of itself, I think, is a misconception that most mainstream journalists never see. I mean, you had a great time today, did you not?
I did. I even hit something.
That was also the experience at the Arizona Daily Star, one media organization that has made a significant effort to improve its gun coverage. The Tucson-based paper sent a number of reporters out shooting with expert trainers, and it held an extensive briefing on gun issues for all employees. Executive editor Bobby Jo Buell.
We had two guys show up with hundreds of weapons, and these guys just talked about the basics of firearms. They took them apart. They allowed employees to take them apart, to handle them.
As a result, Buell says the Daily Star is now making far fewer mistakes. It also changed the nature of the paper's relationship with some of its most interested readers.
I remember a couple of months later, I was driving down the street one day, and I had a talk radio on, and I almost drove off the road. I heard one of these people who had been our biggest critic, and he's still very critical of our editorial page opinions about gun control, but he was on talk radio, and a person called in and started in on the Arizona Daily Star and our agenda and how unfair we are, and he defended us and said, you know, they make mistakes sometimes in the news pages, but I think they're really trying to get it right.
Considering the problems with the media's coverage of guns, the willingness of the Daily Star to acknowledge its mistakes and attempt to learn from them gives the rest of us in the press a nice target to aim for. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited this week by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz and editing help from Jeff Rogers. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the New School in New York City, offering an interdisciplinary graduate program in media studies. Fall application deadline March 15th. Information at nsu.newschool.edu/PRI. Also from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James R. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.